Well, our bishop likes to say that when a parish experiences harmony at the core, the parish is poised for growth. Now, I wanted to get some clarity on what she meant by that, so I talked to her about it, and I've come to understand that what Bishop Melissa means is not that a parish and its people never have any disagreements. I mean, it's not that there's never anything amiss or askew or morally questionable about anything going on in a parish. I mean, shoot, a parish is made up of people, of course, right? But rather that there is nothing set against the key components of parish life. There's nothing set against the priest and other leaders working together fruitfully. There's nothing set against a priest and congregation ready and willing to explore renewed relationship with God and with each other. There's nothing set against us listening to the voice of God and doing the work that God has called us to do. Now, as one gets more experience in this strange thing we attempt, and it is a strange thing, church, right? This living in a faith community. Strange not just from our perspective, though often we think it's strange when we're in it, but strange from the perspective of the world around us, who drive by this building on a Sunday morning going, what in the world are those cars doing there? What's going on in that place anyway? But it's strange just because we mash up these concerns, these people, these interests, and these needs, and we hope something good will come out of it. And often it does. And as you get a sense of the whole, as you are in it and living in it over time, sometimes you'll get this sense of a good spirit about a place. And you'll say that. There's a great spirit about St. Matthew. But some of us have also had a sense when a parish is off kilter. And we'll say things like, there's just a bad spirit about that place, whatever it is. And of course, all things being equal, we can apply that to ourselves. Sometimes there's fundamental clashes going on inside of us. We can talk about families or companies. We can talk about hospitals. They all have this potential of the good spirit and the bad spirit, if you will, and everything in between. Harmony at the core. It's really difficult to describe, but you feel it when you're in it. And it's difficult to determine the causes of its absence, yet you know when it's missing. In yourself, in your family, in the organizations you're part of. Now, even though Israel had made it back from exile, a huge, momentous feat, something almost unheard of in the ancient world. A country utterly exiled, brought back to its land, and somehow reestablished. Even though that had happened, even though the temple sacrifices had been restored and were now happening on a daily basis, those who were prophetically inclined, that is, they had a good sense of the whole. That's really what we mean by prophetic inclination or discernment, they could discern that there was not harmony at the core of Israel's common life. And it wasn't just Rome's oppression, though that was a huge part of it. It was that key components of Israel's identity were at war, were set against each other. Leaders and people had different religious visions, were often at odds. Synagogue leaders and parishioners were looking for different types of security. There was quite literally, in terms of today's reading, a bad spirit about the place. Everyone knew, though, that when Messiah would come, the Messiah would exercise the ministry of shalom, that is, peace in its widest possible sense, a holistic understanding of politics, communal politics that would renew the covenant amongst the tribes with God. The Messiah was going to heal the sick, feed the hungry, and bring creation and humans back into harmony. Even Israel's enemies would get to be part of this new order. These events, which can seem so strange to many of us in the modern world, would have seemed signs of the good spirit, signs that Jesus probably was the one. Of course, to us, any one or particular event we read about in the Gospels is open to question. Our modern minds are fixated on the historical. Did this or that happen in the way that it's described? We don't know. Most scholars, and from very widely differing theological backgrounds, take a different approach to the Gospels. Whatever they may think about any one event, they agree that on the whole, Jesus did remarkable, mighty works. That is, people living in Jesus' time and place believed that he was exercising the divine power. And it makes sense for us, these scholars will tell us, however attuned we are to the laws of physics, however attuned we are to a historical consciousness, to take this testimony as credible, to take it with a seriousness it deserves. I was listening to, maybe some of you heard this too, a very interesting episode of the CBC show Ideas this last Tuesday night, recounting the work of the anthropologist Wade Davis. He's been witness to the fact that many so-called primitive cultures actually have a far more sophisticated vision of what a human being is than our narrow Western ideas. You see, in the West, we're cut off often from our environment, with the result that we don't see or understand the forces that are actively shaping us. These mighty works of Jesus were taken by the people who were looking to God, not as one would take the works of a magician or an illusionist, but as someone who was able to deal with the forces that were shaping them, that are shaping us. They took these acts as the fulfillment of the true prophet, the true prophecy pointed at in our first reading, a belief that God's kingdom, rule and reign, was coming close. But he, even having said all of that, even having set the table thusly, there is something remarkable about Jesus' ministry in the Gospel of Mark in particular, which, by the way, is Mark's symbol is the lion. That's why he's on your bulletin this morning. He just kind of roars at you. He comes at you. And it's a strong message. So the remarkable thing about Jesus in the book of Mark is not least in terms of his battle with what is literally in the Greek, the Satan, the accuser, and the spirits that are associated with this accuser. You see, there are no predictions in the Hebrew scriptures that the Messiah would engage in this kind of ministry. Nor, should I add, has this type of ministry, however Hollywood portrays it, right? And maybe with a few exceptions, been a major focus of the life and work of the church. Jesus and the gospel writers, then, are signaling that something deeper than the expected messianic battle with the physical, say the Roman armies, Roman legions, and the economic oppressors, the religious elite, Herod and all of that, and again Rome, something deeper than that is taking place through Jesus. Perhaps we are meant to think this. Jesus' battle seems to be with those forces that control the forces that shape us. Like when you watch the first Star Wars trilogy, Anybody? Come on. You can admit it. It isn't until the third film that you're exposed, not just to Darth Vader, right? Darth Vader, uber villain, really bad guy. But then you get to see the ultimate dark power, the Emperor himself. And what we see then in our gospel reading today, and what we will see in other instances in Mark's gospel, is not simply the release from what we might consider a strange bondage for a few poor, unfortunate individuals, nor does it seem to be that our Lord is healing instances of what we would now call mental illness or epilepsy. If there is a connection, we need to be careful, right? Because these texts have been used to stigmatize mental illness as some wild danger. Not a comfortable stigma, as some of us who suffer from mental illness will understand. And if any of you suffer from or know someone who's had the misfortune of suffering an epileptic fit, you know that what's described in these scenes is not what's going on either. Like Wade Davis, who has opened for us the sophisticated, integrated view of how divine powers and the world and community interact with each other in the different tribes of the Amazon basin, these exorcisms, I think, better serve as windows into the depth of Jesus' ministry. Yes, there's a person involved, and Jesus is bringing relief to this person, bringing them to what is called in other places soundness of mind, by which he doesn't mean the healing of a mental illness, but balance, shalom, the equivalent of integration. For when Jesus shows up these spirits, somehow, maybe you noticed this in today's reading, it gives voice to someone's pain, and the person is not marked out as evil. The person isn't scapegoated, but they're marked out for healing. In addition, the voice of the spirit or the person, and we want an integrated view here, speaks not only for itself or himself, but for the group. There's a kind of reverse of the canary in the coal mine effect, if you will. You know about the canary in the coal mine? As long as the canary is singing, there's oxygen in the mine and it's safe. Right? Something like the opposite of that is happening here. I find it remarkable and powerful that Jesus' first exorcism, the first of these mighty works, takes place in a synagogue, in church, in an environment like this, if you will. Not in the marketplace, not in the village square, but in a house of worship, which was at the foundation of Israel's life and being. The deep healing our culture and society craves, though it is afraid to approach it, must begin with the communities of faith, Mark is saying. If the good spirit is welcome here, there's hope. But if communities of faith collude with the powers of darkness, then we can expect that our society is in for a truly rough ride. And so we see that the parishioner affected becomes the conduit through which the electricity can flow, through which the intent of the depth of Jesus' ministry can be revealed. Using the radical language of our second reading, the weak link becomes in his weakness the one who reveals what the strong cannot reveal. Reveals the hidden hurts of the community. Jesus is among us to do what no surface rearranging of the deck chairs can accomplish. Jesus is here to right the ship itself. That's something that's very powerful. Jesus is the one who exposes where the underwater icebergs have ripped away at our personal and our communal fabric. He exposes our fears, in other words. God, have you come to destroy us? Is there a future for me, for you? Is there a future for us? What are our deepest fears? When Jesus is among us, you and I become less afraid to be honest about our deep hurts and declare who Jesus is. It's one of the great signs of the presence of Christ. When a congregation is getting more courageous, getting braver, which is what I said last week, so I won't preach that sermon again. And when he does, there is healing and hope in even his strongest words. Silence. Come out of him. Come out of them. Come out of us. Speaking to the Spirit, yes, but not shutting the man down. Not shutting the man down, but creating not more words, if you will, but space for healing, for awareness of God in the depths, for a replacement of the bad spirit with the good spirit. And so we should expect, as we listen to all the voices of our community, that weakness, that an unexpected voice will reveal Christ's strength. However awkward that sometimes is. We know that harmony at the core is what Christ is after. Whether it's personally, in our families, in our parishes, harmony at the core. And it's Christ's very presence among us as we come to this table, as we take the risk to trust that Christ's mighty works are possible still. That is the key. God is here not to give us just more information, but to build us up. Love is here to build us up. Amen.